Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Good to hear from you.
So, a 2023 paper led by Sarah Kang said, quote, "Recent global climate feedback is controlled by Southern Ocean cooling." That's a huge statement. The Southern Ocean regulates climate feedback. Do you agree?
Yeah, so this is something that I think we've come to a greater appreciation for in recent years. The Southern Ocean has an outsized influence on the climate system. That's something that we've known for a very long time. Locally, through its uptake of heat and carbon, sort of serving as a buffer against climate change. But its impacts aren't just local. They're further afield as well. And so what that global climate feedback is referring to is the adjustments in the climate system that happen under an increase in greenhouse gases. And these adjustments could either amplify the warming that you get or damp the warming. And what we've come to understand is when you have this multi-decadal period of cooling in the Southern Ocean that you referred to, what it tends to do is have influence on sea surface temperatures in the tropics, particularly in the tropical Pacific. And what this does, it has an impact, for instance, on the reflectivity of clouds, on ocean heat uptake, and tends to lead to a more, what we call a La Nina-like sea surface temperature pattern, where you have colder than normal sea surface temperatures in the eastern Pacific. So when this happens, it leads to what we call a reduction in climate sensitivity. So the amount of warming that you would expect for a given amount of greenhouse gas emissions is lower when you have these negative feedbacks at play. So yes, in short, I do agree with that statement. So this is definitely still an active area of research in terms of the mechanisms underpinning this.
Well, before we go further, we have to get in a couple of basics. What is the mixed layer, and how is that different from things like sea surface temperatures?
So in the ocean, the mixed layer is the layer of the ocean that is homogenized and well-mixed and directly responds to forcings from the atmosphere, so things like wind, like evaporation. You know, you can't see this with your own eyes, but a good way to visualize the ocean is sort of as this kind of layer cake of different water masses of different densities, so lighter density on top, higher density below. And this mixed layer is this uppermost layer, where you have the same temperature and salinity throughout this mixed layer. And then at the bottom, we have this sharp density gradient that kind of isolates the mixed layer from the ocean below it. So it's a sort of a distinct water mass in that sense.
Well, most of us think the ocean gets colder as you go deeper, but your study, at least talking about the Southern Ocean, gets to deeper waters that are warmer than the surface. How does that work?
Yeah, so this is a rather counterintuitive aspect of the ocean at higher latitudes near the pole, and particularly in the Southern Ocean. So your intuition is correct that we would often expect warm water to be on top of cold water because warm water, all else being equal, is less dense. It turns out at high latitudes, however, that the dominant control on your ocean density is not temperature, but rather salinity. And so because of that, in the Southern Ocean, what you tend to have is these warm, salty water masses below the mixed layer. And because of that, because the ocean at depth is saltier, you can have cold water on top of warm water, provided that cold water in the mixed layer is sufficiently fresh or less salty than the water below it. So that it's really salinity that's determining that vertical structure.
Well, large as it is, Antarctica is a small part of the Southern Ocean. Is ocean cooling just around that continent, and is cooler water transported further north?
So first I should say, in terms of this multi-decadal cooling in the Southern Ocean, it's worth mentioning that this trend has abruptly reversed in recent years for reasons that we are still trying to understand. But in general, you know, if you think on multi-decadal timescales, we've long expected that warming will be delayed in the Southern Ocean relative to other parts of the world. This cold water can be moved further north towards the equator, and this contributes to some of those teleconnections with the tropics that I referred to earlier. And that paper led by Sarah Kang studies as well.
Your group found at least five explanations or drivers that might cause the Southern Ocean to cool despite global warming. You chose to focus on one. Please tell us about that.
The mechanism that we focused on is an increasing input of fresh water into the Southern Ocean that is making that mixed layer near the surface more fresh. So as I was saying before, one reason we think that this could be contributing to this multi-decadal cooling that we saw is that when you add this fresh water, it stratifies the mixed layer, and so it makes it harder to mix the warmer water below up towards the surface. So in other words, that warm water is trapped at depth as opposed to being able to make it to the surface. And for a variety of reasons, we believe that climate models, the things that we are using to make future projections of climate change, aren't capturing the freshening trend adequately. And that's led to some biases in these climate models that we want to correct. And so we set out to see if we corrected this underestimated freshening trend in the Southern Ocean, what would that do? And what we found is that it is able to explain a substantial gap between the sea surface temperatures that we see in models and observations, and this freshening trend is already having an important influence on the Southern Ocean and perhaps much, much further afield as well.
So is this fresh water just coming from Antarctic ice?
No. So we focused on two sources of fresh water. One, as you said, is from the Antarctic ice sheet, which has been losing mass in recent decades. So about between 100 to 300 gigatons of anomalous meltwater from the Antarctic ice sheet. When you melt landmass ice, that ice is a source of fresh water. So in other words, it freshens the ocean when it melts. The other thing that we looked at were changes in precipitation, so changes in rain and snow falling on the Southern Ocean, and that's been another source of freshening as well, largely because of a shift in the storm track further south into the Southern Ocean, and also this general feature that we expect with global warming called wet gets wetter, dry gets drier. So in other words, in a warming climate, what we expect are our wet regions, like the Southern Ocean, to receive even more precipitation than they were in the past, and then dry regions get drier. And so what we found is that on climate models, they aren't accounting for this fresh water from the Antarctic ice sheet that changes the ocean circulation. And then we also, these climate models are underestimating the increase in precipitation that's been falling as well.
Does most of the increasing rainfall or snowfall in far southern latitudes fall into the ocean or onto the Antarctic itself? And does that balance matter?
It does. So most of it is falling on the ocean itself. So this may be surprising given that Antarctica is covered in frozen water, but Antarctica is actually quite a dry continent. Not much rain and snow falls on Antarctica relative to further north. You know, basically the reason that ice sticks around is the snow that does fall does not melt. It accumulates. But that balance is important. And if you have the amount of precipitation that falls on Antarctica year to year, can of course then have downstream impacts on what melts later. But in short, the majority of the precipitation that we were focused on in our study is what falls directly onto the Southern Ocean, and particularly where the strong storm track that encircles this ocean is located.
And we have seen news about atmospheric rivers roaring across the Southern Oceans all the way to Antarctica, dropping big loads of rain or snow and bringing warmer air. Talk to us about the role of atmospheric rivers in southern seas.
So atmospheric rivers, they are these structures in the atmosphere that can bring large amounts of precipitation in short periods. They tend to often tap moisture sources and air masses from the tropics as well, so they can often be quite warm. And so when you get an atmospheric river event, it can lead to much warmer than average conditions. It can lead to a reduction in sea ice, you know, either from just the mechanical forcing associated with the wind in the storm or for just the rain falling on snow, for instance. So particularly in recent years, when we've seen this really anomalously low sea ice in the Southern Ocean, there's been a lot of work looking into what the role of the atmospheric rivers could be playing in this.
Scientists point to ways changes in the Southern Ocean impact systems in other oceans. Does it go the other way? For example, would a strong El Nino affect the Southern Ocean too?
Yeah, so this is, you know, one of the large, what you're touching on is just a large challenge in climate science in general, which is determining the direction of causality between various processes, because often indeed that causality can go in both directions. So, you know, at the beginning of our conversation, you referenced the possibility that the Southern Ocean could be influencing things like El Nino in the tropics, but indeed it can go the other way as well. So the Southern Ocean storm track also responds to El Nino. I think this is definitely at the frontier of our understanding right now, but there's been a lot of work looking at the possibility of a two-way teleconnection between the Southern Ocean and the tropics. And indeed, how strong that link is going to depend on things like the properties of clouds and so forth. And so it's really important that we resolve these processes correctly in climate models to capture this connection between the Southern Ocean and the tropics. And we tend to see, again, that colder conditions in the Southern Ocean tend to be associated with a more La Nina-like sea surface temperature pattern in the tropics, where your eastern tropical Pacific is colder than average. So then that begs the question, what's the chicken and what's the egg, right? What initiated that change? Was it a change in the tropics that first initiated this? Was it a change in the Southern Ocean that first initiated this? And then, of course, what are the relative roles of climate change versus just internal variability and random noise in the climate system? And these are all open questions.
What a great problem. It's a moving target in a somewhat chaotic system that has patterns. It's really difficult to do what we're trying to do, to see into the future, and yet we have to do it.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Zach Kaufman. We're talking about the unknown sea, the Southern Ocean. Have to be honest, many of us glaze over when scientists start talking about salinity and seawater. But your paper and countless others, salinity is identified as a key to ocean function and global heat transport. Could you introduce us to the salinity factors in your 2025 study?
The role that salinity plays in the Southern Ocean is that it determines the sort of the degree to which water near the surface is connected with water below it. And so what salinity does is it determines the stratification of your water. So the way that I like to think about this is, you know, you put salad dressing in the refrigerator, and overnight the waters of the liquids of different densities in that salad dressing separate out, and you get these layers with, you know, the olive oil in one layer and the balsamic vinegar in another layer. And what salinity does is it determines that strength of stratification that you get in the ocean. The reason we focus on salinity in our paper is that has really important implications for just the broad scale circulation of the Southern Ocean. You know, what are the temperature trends going to be? And then, you know, how much heat is going to be stored at depth? Is it staying at depth, or is it going to make it to the surface?
When it comes to fresh water from Antarctic ice, we picture water dribbling off the cliffs or chunks falling into the sea. Your paper adds ice shelf mass loss. What is that, and how does that contribute to cooling in the sea?
Yeah, the really interesting thing about Antarctica is that a lot of the meltwater that is entering the ocean comes through what is called basal melting. And so the word basal is referring to the base of ice shelves. So these ice shelves are out floating on the ocean. They're connected to the continent, but these basically these big tongues of ice that come out from the continent and then are floating on top of the ocean, and they're exposed to warm water at their base. So there are these cavities under the ice shelves that you know, we can't see from a top-down perspective, but if you were to, you know, take a submersible under the ice shelf, you would be able to see this. And this happens to be where a lot of that melt water comes from. You know, sometimes we don't think about these ice shelves because the meltwater from these ice shelves aren't going to directly contribute to sea level rise because they're coming from ice that's already floating on the ocean to begin with. But that meltwater can have really important implications for the global ocean circulation because, of course, the amount of meltwater coming from these ice shelves is going to influence the salinity of the ocean.
So is the sea in the Southern Ocean actually cooling, or is it cooling relative to other oceans which are warming up?
The answer to this question will have changed, you know, in recent years. So from probably we've had reliable satellite observations of sea ice and sea surface temperature for about the past 40 to 50 years. And what we saw from around 1979 to 2014, 2015 was this very, very, you know, very weak, not particularly significant cooling trend. But it was notable nonetheless because it's occurring against the backdrop of global warming, which points to, you know, a unique situation in the Southern Ocean. And then since 2015, this very weak cooling trend has abruptly reversed. And to give an idea of how abrupt this change is, the Antarctic winter sea ice loss that occurred over the past decade is of similar magnitude to the total Arctic sea ice loss that occurred over the past 40 years. So this change happened really quickly. And so that cooling trend seems to have reversed. Whether that's a permanent reversal to a new state is the signal of global warming now finally emerging in the Southern Ocean. A delayed emergence of the warming signal, or is this, you know, a temporary shift and that we could expect more cooling into the future is still an open question. What our study suggests is that this Antarctic meltwater, which we expect to increase in the coming decades, is really helping to delay warming in the region. It's already having an impact, but clearly it's been outweighed by other factors in recent years.
But the best climate-coupled models in the world did not predict that cooling trend while it was existing. What is the problem with the models?
So what our study focused on was this underestimated freshwater input. And, you know, part of, with climate models, one challenge that you face is that the more comprehensive model that you have, you tend to lose some details in the process of making it global and very comprehensive. And one thing that it just doesn't account for is this increasing flux of Antarctic meltwater into the Southern Ocean. That's just a forcing on the Southern Ocean that's completely missing from these models. And so, you know, what one way that you can check this is we do things called historical simulations, where we subject our climate model to the conditions of the historical period that we have observations for, and then we look and see, okay, how well does this model simulator reproduce our observations? And what we've seen is that pretty consistently these models would have expected the Southern Ocean to be warming decades ago, whereas in observations we've only seen it since 2015. And so what our study points to is that it's these missing freshwater sources that have led to that discrepancy between models and observations. And of course, these things are just important to resolve and explain, because to have confidence in our future projections of climate change, we need to know that they can at least somewhat reproduce the observed state of the climate that we see in observations.
It is dangerous to travel in the Southern Ocean. The storms and the winds are legendary. A new paper, December 3rd, 2025, suggests ocean warming in the southern summer is regulated by these storms. does world climate partly depend on winds and storms in the Southern Ocean? And is there any suggestion those might change in a warming world?
You know, I've been focused on freshwater in our conversation thus far, but winds are another very important factor, I would say probably among the top three in determining temperature and salinity in the Southern Ocean. As you mentioned, the Southern Ocean, just from its geography, it encircles the globe, and there are no continents to break up the storm track between, you know, the latitudes of around, say, you know, 55 to 65 degrees south. And so you have these really strong winds blowing from west to east. We call this the Southern Ocean storm track. And what we've seen is that this storm track has both been strengthening and shifting poleward in recent years, and we expect that to continue into the future. There are two drivers of this. One is you know, climate change, global warming, but also interestingly the ozone hole as well is thought to contribute to this trend as well. What that does is you have a larger winds on the surface, and what that can do is increase mixing to help bring warm water from depth to the surface, so the opposite of what fresh water does. And so perhaps some of this trend reversal that we've seen in recent years may be this tug of war between changes in wind and changes in freshwater input. And if this wind-driven mixing is winning out and deepening our mixed layer, sort of then we would expect indeed for the temperature trend to reverse as well.
Have you heard anything about a tipping point in any of these processes we're talking about?
Tipping points are typically defined as the substantial, widespread, and irreversible changes in the climate system. So there's a number of tipping points that we worry about in this part of the world. One is that these ice shelves, which I mentioned earlier, if they melt and thin very quickly, they basically buttress and hold back the flow of ice from the rest of the continent above it. And so if those ice shelves disintegrate, you can very rapidly increase the flow and melt of ice from the Antarctic continent and lead to a very sort of abrupt increase in sea level rise. So that's one tipping point that people are worried about. Another, which I think is perhaps more closely related to my study that we've been talking about, is the overturning ocean circulation. And so the ocean circulation globally, we can think of it as a conveyor belt with waters sinking at high latitudes and then moving towards the equator and upwelling. And this is really important for storage of heat and carbon dioxide in our oceans. If we are increasing the stratification of our ocean with freshwater, we can slow down this overturning circulation. People think about this a lot in the Northern Hemisphere. In fact, it's the premise for the movie The Day After Tomorrow. So people may be familiar about this process, which happens in the Northern Hemisphere as well. But we do believe that this overturning circulation near Antarctica has been slowing down in recent decades.
You know, as we wrap up here, I don't want to leave this as a problem just for scientists and modelers. I think fundamental changes in the Southern Ocean could alter the future of the world. What do you say?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think it's an underappreciated region for two reasons. One is, of course, the human population in that part of the world is quite low. Antarctica is not inhabited by any permanent settlements other than scientific research stations. So oftentimes it can seem out of sight, out of mind. And then also it's a very hard place to explore. It's a very hostile condition. And so we are only just starting to really get comprehensive observations for this part of the world. It's still a very data sparse region. But it's really important that we improve those observations because, as we've been talking about, changes that happen in the Southern Ocean don't stay in the Southern Ocean. It's really an area that has an outsized impact on the global climate system. And it's the future trajectory of temperature trends there, whether do we expect a return to this kind of weak cooling trend or delayed warming, or have we entered a new regime of rapid warming in the Southern Ocean? How that that changes into the future is really going to determine the rate of global warming and impact, you know, everything from sea level rise to global weather systems. So anyone who's interested in the climate and interested in trying to understand what the future holds, I think should be paying a lot of attention to this region.
We have been speaking with Dr. Zachary Kaufman from Scripps Institute in San Diego. He is lead author of the paper, The Impact of Underestimated Southern Ocean Freshening on Simulated Historical Sea Surface Temperature Trends. Find links to the science in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Zach, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Coming up next week, our annual holiday music special. Listen for a whole hour of Radio EcoShock climate music for those in the fire and flood zones, for ordinary people caught up in the climate whirlwind. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Down at the bottom of the world, where no one goes, hidden giants, hidden change that no one knows. Penguins, seals, and krill lose their icy homes. Hidden waters change their ways.
Are boldly colorful icons of northern islands and sea cliffs, where they nest in dense colonies during the summer. In the spring, puffins grow thin, blazingly colorful layers over the base of their huge beaks. Some species' beaks turn vivid yellow, others a bright red or orange, and they make all kinds of noise. In winter, however, puffins lead very different lives. For one thing, winter puffins are not nearly as fancy. Once their chicks fledge in late summer, adult puffins shed the ornaments that wowed their mates in spring. Their beaks turn a dull orange, and their bright white summer faces turn a sooty color. Tufted puffins, named for their long blonde head tufts, go tuft-less in winter. Horned puffins lose the fleshy horns above their eyes. And puffins in winter go silent as well. The birds depart their nesting cliffs by September and head for the open ocean. Three species winter in the North Pacific and one in the North Atlantic. Puffins remain largely solitary for the 7 months of the year they spend at sea. But as winter gives way to spring, the clowns of the cliffs return, once again outfitted in their finest colors. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
CJSF.